Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Dedicated to Edgar Degas, 1834 to 1917, in the centennial year of his death, Volume 3 of the Conservation Division's biennial journal, Factor, Conservation, Science, Art History, focuses on the tremendous wealth of works by Degas in the National Gallery of Art collection. The first to feature the work of a single artist, this issue includes essays by conservators, scientists, and curators. It presents insights into Degas' working methods in painting, sculpture in wax, and bronze, and works on paper, as well as a sonnet he wrote to his Little Dancer. The gallery has the third largest collection in the world of work by Degas, comprising 21 paintings, 65 sculptures, 34 drawings, 40 prints, 2 copper plates, and 1 volume of soft ground etchings. Its extensive Degas holdings and conservation resources have inspired not only groundbreaking gallery exhibitions, such as Degas the Dancers, 1984, Degas at the Races, 1998, Degas Little Dancer, 2014, and Degas Cassatt, 2014, but also exhibitions around the world. For the public symposium, held as a centenary tribute on September 22, 2017, Anne Honingswall shared insights into Degas' compulsive working sessions and his inability to finish a work of art. She described various surfaces, often found in the same work, used by Degas, who valued flexibility and potential over preservation and closure.
Deciphering the ambiguity of Degas' paint layers and understanding the process is absolutely enhanced by the collaboration between the art historians and conservators and conservation scientists. And for me, apart from sitting at the easel and treating paintings, the most satisfying part of my job is that collaborative effort. And the work that I'm going to present today results from a very intense probing that I did with Kimberly Jones, who's our senior curator of 19th century French paintings. She wrote the paper with me that's in Factor, and she's not here today, so I'm presenting on her behalf. A particular question, or Degas question, had been really intriguing the two of us for years. And the issue is, if a painting is signed, can we actually assume that it's finished? And what about some of the other markers of finish? What is characteristic for many artists, however, simply doesn't apply to Degas, and I think you've already heard that today. That's precisely what makes Degas so interesting. Nothing is really straightforward. This is an artist who began his career almost timidly. He was drawing and painting at first, and then he was painting in a very academic style. He's an admirer and also a collector of artists like Ang, and he was creating enamel-like surfaces to render really the most subtle, the most blended effect that he could get with his brush. However, towards the end of his life, like we saw with printmaking, what he's doing with paintings is completely different. He really, one, he had a very long career, but also he moved in directions that were directions taken by very few other artists. Now, what you've already heard, so many of speakers today have talked about Degas being experimental, and that's for a good reason. As a painter, he never restricted himself to the established techniques or the ways of painting. His choice of materials alone revealed that he was never restricted by convention. Besides two paints, he was also mixing his media. He was incorporating metallic paints and distemper, which is a glue medium. He was using tempera, which is an egg-based medium. He's also manipulating pastel, as we know now, and thinning his commercial paints, which when he does that, he was creating something that's called peinture à l'essence, where he can get a very different effect, a transparent effect with his oil paints. At times, he was essentially abusing his oils, often really ignoring traditional technique by scraping and digging into the layers. He's often using the end of his brush as well as the bristles. He would be wiping with rags and even applying paint with his fingers. I'm beginning to think we should probably have called this entire day Degas' fingerprints. sometimes even using the ends of corks from wine bottles. Now, none of his materials were unfamiliar to an artist, but Degas actually challenged himself to see how he could use conventional media in a completely new way, and that was radical. For a conservator who's interested in the materials and techniques of painters and the process of painting, Degas is particularly captivating, and one of the topics, as I've mentioned, is this whole question of a finish in his pictures. They often appear incomplete, and that I show this picture because this is definitely one that we've been questioning. But then we had to ask, were they? This is a man who said, my greatest pleasure consists of starting over and over again. And as conservators, we have the capability now to look beneath the surface. We use X-radiographs, which penetrate through all the layers of a painting, and we also use infrared images, and we use the microscope, which allows us to look with magnification. Today we also, I have to say, there's a certain cachet to what's called the non finito, or the unfinished painting. However, historically, collectors often dismissed pictures if they appeared incomplete. And dealers in particular were very concerned that they wouldn't be able to sell a picture for a good price. And they actually sometimes had restorers come in and sort of finish paintings so they could increase the value. Now, the fate of many unfinished pictures was actually, though, to remain abandoned in the studio. They were often acquired by artists or very eccentric collectors, or sadly, they were often simply destroyed. Traditionally, French painters were expected to produce a very, very highly polished surface, which is what you see here. And this was the established aesthetic idea. It was codified by the rigorous training that artists would receive in France. It was reinforced by the conservative tastes of the juries of the official Paris Salon. And yet by the end, by sort of the middle of the 19th century, artists started to question a lot of this underlying practice of conventional finish. And the issue was often ambiguous, in fact, because softly or freely applied paint was always, in fact, a part of an artist's technique, and in many cases was intentionally used for very specific effect. Degas, for example, incorporated less defined areas to imply reflections, as you see here. The loosely painted figure at the left is simply the mirror image of the woman. It's not incomplete. In other cases, a range of handling enhanced the development of space in a composition. Now, the distinction between the foreground and the background in this painting was accentuated by the contrast of paint application. Very, very precise in the figures that you see in the foreground and in the orchestra pit, but very, very soft and loose on the stage. I'm convinced that Degas deliberately allowed visible pentimenti in this picture, The Song Lesson, to expose these remnants of numerous attempts to reposition the arms, the furniture, and the architectural details. And all of this gave the illusion of something unfinished, even though he had started it with very, very precise drawings, and a great deal of detail is visible in the painting as well. It's unclear if he would have returned to this picture later. We really don't know. But there are a lot of pictures that simply appear incomplete. This one in Brooklyn, the question is it finished? This painting that's in Cambridge, it's another one. We really don't know. I personally think these are finished works. I think this is where he left them, and I think as products of the 19th century, it was in fact acceptable. Traditionally, there are certain indicators that denote when a work of art is considered complete. Submission for public exhibition, sale of a work of art, or the gift of a work of art, the presence of a signature, or the application of varnish. Now, in the case of Degas, these established markers don't necessarily always apply, though. Because Degas exhibited very sporadically, especially after 1886, much of his work was never shown publicly. When he did exhibit, however, he was apt to submit sketches alongside more finished works. And for the Impressionist exhibition of 1876, for example, Degas chose to show two signed works. They were both painted in New Orleans when he was there visiting family, very meticulously executed cotton office, as well as this very, very loosely handled Children on the Doorstep. To display works of such startling range of finish seems, I think, willfully provocative on his part. And it actually led one critic to observe that we encountered some excellent sketches there, but we didn't see a truly finished painting, though, by Monsieur Degas. In the case of Degas, the presence or absence of an artist's signature, the most visible sign, seems sort of the most obvious sign of a work's completion, can actually be very misleading. Significant number of paintings were never signed. While some works bear multiple signatures, so you can go the whole gamut. And this picture of the writer says all the elements of an unfinished composition. It's very sketchy. The paint is transparent. You see a lot of visible drawing. You see the ground layer through the paint. There's very little detail in it. And yet, it's signed. However, a large work like the Bellelli family shows very high degree of polish. And in fact, the absence of a signature seems like a rather odd oversight. In contrast, other works are clearly signed, though they seem to push the boundaries entirely of what could be considered finished. His signed portrait of Madame Gobiard, which doesn't seem to have advanced much beyond the stage of an ébauche or an underpainting, seems to be a very good example of this. Similarly, the signed ballet scene, which we've already seen, exposes, in fact, I think it really emphasizes the preparatory drawing and all the alterations he made on this. He was clearly a man of great contradiction. Now, because the conservator's goal is to remain true to an artist's intent, we are particularly interested in whether or not an artist preferred to have their works varnished. A painting was traditionally coated both to protect the surface and to saturate the colors. However, it's an even less reliable barometer of completion than the signature because it's actually rather difficult to pin down precisely when a painting was initially varnished. One interesting exception, though, is this painting that we see here. In an account that a visit to Degas' studio in 1885, the British painter Walter Sickert described watching Degas glaze a painting representing a woman drifting through a picture gallery with a flow of varnish by means of a large brush. Based on Sickert's report, there can't be any question that this is the painting which he was referring to, and yet it seems like a very odd candidate for varnishing. It's a picture that's a sort of curious mix. The woman's features are very carefully rendered. There it goes. And her body is very well defined, but in the background, the paint is laid in with these quick, swift strokes, very, very fluid paint, very, very abstract and amorphous. In light of this disjunction between the figure and the setting, one quite common in Degas' oeuvre, it would seem perfectly easy to assume that this was also an unfinished work if it hadn't been for Sickert's account. And even more telling story about Degas and varnish is linked to his painting of Mademoiselle Eugénie Fiocre. Degas, who was still working on this painting just moments before an exhibition, apparently applied a layer of varnish to the composition. Now, he was very displeased with the result, apparently, and the artist later removed the coating, and with it came a great deal of original paint. It dissolved because the fresh colors were still soluble. We know this from written observations. And one person then said, so as not to destroy the whole thing, the work had to be left unfinished. Much later, Degas got into his head to work on it some more. He engaged a restorer who removed what remained of the varnish and who repainted the damage Degas had already done to his own work. Now, this anecdote highlights several crucial factors that contribute to this whole question about finish throughout the artist's career. His inability to work to a deadline, his complete mismanagement of time, his outsized ambition, unrealistic expectation of what he could accomplish, and acute perfectionism, but most importantly, perhaps, his absolute reluctance to part with any of his works of art. An even greater challenge to understanding Degas' relationship to finish was his tendency to rework many canvases, sometimes years or decades after having first had them on his easel. Now, as I mentioned, Degas held fast to his work. Looking at the catalogs of the posthumous sales of Degas' studio effects reveals a staggering number of works that remained in his possession spanning his entire career. Some paintings, such as the Bellelli family, escaped unscathed, but those really do appear to be the exception. Interestingly, this tendency to rework canvases is one of the many practices that distinguished Degas from other artists from the Impressionist circle in the 1860s. Renoir appears to have destroyed his youthful failures. I just had to get a little bit of Bazille in here still. His friend Bazille simply painted over his early compositions. Manet, you may know, cut down unsuccessful pictures, retaining only those fragments that he in fact found pleasing. But Degas' response to when he was dissatisfied with works could be in fact just as damaging. And all too often, he simply didn't know when to step away. Now, started in 1866, The Fallen Jockey is a very good example of Degas' extensive reworking. And as was typical at this point in his career, Degas produced numerous preparatory drawings and planning the overall composition. However, despite its ambitious scale and novel subject, the painting passed largely unnoticed the first time it was exhibited in 1866. Degas appears to have reworked part of the canvas, and then that was actually the first of three transformations carried out over a span of 30 years. He removed paint by scraping and abusing it. He was digging and he was deliberately exposing the underlayers of his picture. And he did this with the intent that they remain visible, very much as a sort of a calculated remnant of what came before. The artist left these references, and this, as in so many others, the pentimenti or the artist changes and these initial tones that peek through, the appearance of impasto on the surface or thickly applied dried paint, these all suggest hidden elements in earlier compositions. In addition, related drawings point to and reference the development, and all of this focuses explicitly on process. Now, although the X-radiograph and the infrared images enhance our understanding of the alterations, the naked eye alone can already identify extra legs, extra tails and heads of the galloping horses, and this really adds a layer of complexity. This is not an easy painting to try to figure out. Degas deliberately chose to draw attention, though, to the metamorphosis of the composition, and the result presents an impression of an unfinished work. But with Degas, finished is simply a subjective term. In 1880, the artist Mary Cassatt approached her friend Degas, and asked about acquiring the painting for her brother Alexander, and this prompted Degas to go and further work the canvas. Now, Cassatt's mother, Catherine, who held a less than glowing opinion of Degas' ability to meet his obligations, already expressed her reservations to her son Alexander, noting that as it's finished, I doubt he'll ever sell it. As it's unfinished, I doubt he'll ever sell it. And it was at this juncture, it appears, that Degas then painted out the riderless horse in the center of the painting and added two new horses. He manipulated the heads and when we looked at the infrared image of the painting, which allows us to go just below the paint surface, we could see the elongated first horse and that it ran horizontally rather than this somewhat diagonally painting a horse that was going across the width of the canvas. Now, these changes seem to be compositional in part, but again, I think what they do is have more to do with defining space than anything else. In the mid-1890s, Degas returned again to this picture. This time, he was introducing a dramatic overlay of vibrant pink color to the sky. He was intensifying the jockey's silks, as well as adding a row of trees in the distance. He outlined all of these horses in black. At this point, virtually every inch of the canvas was reworked, except for one very striking and poignant exception, and that was this delicately and beautifully painted face of the fallen jockey. And this, in fact, is a portrait of the artist's brother, Achille, who had died in 1893. And this one element was left untouched. Mrs. Cassatt's prediction that Degas would never sell this painting proved truer than she realized. Speaking of Degas' behavior, she had further observed, he says, it's one of those works which are sold after a man's death and artists buy them, not caring whether they're finished or not. Degas' compulsive reworking of his art was not limited to the paintings that remained in his possession. It actually extended to those that had left his studio. His friend Henri Rouart is said to have chained his painting, Dancer Practicing at the Bar, to the wall in his home in order to thwart Degas' attempts to take it back so that he could remove the watering can that he had grown to dislike. Now, apparently, we've always loved the story of the chains, apparently it's fictional, but Rouart's concern was warranted, remembering that Degas had once reclaimed a pastel for retouching, only to see it demolished in the artist's hands. So Jean-Baptiste Faure, a renowned opera singer and important art collector, had a similarly unhappy encounter with Degas due to the artist's need to rework his canvases. Now in 1874, at Degas' behest, Faure bought back six pictures from Degas' dealer so that Degas could reconsider them. Now unfortunately, the artist was unable to meet his obligations to Faure, and 13 years later, only three of the promised paintings had in fact been delivered, and this forced Faure to take Degas to court to resolve the matter. And among the contested works were two paintings depicting a woman ironing. This is the version now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which was one of the six paintings repurchased by Faure, and this version, which is in the collection of the National Gallery. And that's the one that was created especially for Faure after the fact. The paint layers of the earlier work have been extensively scraped down, and changes are evident from ghost forms and traction crackle that we can see on the surface. And even with the naked eye, one can see that what was the initial signature is now partially obscured beneath a top paint layer. Now, rather than giving back this reworked canvas to Faure, Degas, in the end, kept it. And I think this is very interesting and very telling that he chose to keep the manipulated version, because I'm convinced he wanted to be reminded of this whole sense of development. But then he produced what's now the Washington version for the collector. And now, while the painting seems more immediate, interestingly, technical imaging confirms that Degas made endless alterations to the National Gallery composition as well. The laundry was repositioned many times over. The linen, you can see, is hanging over the edge of the table. The laundress's back is hunched over more, contour of her face, contour of her arms. All of these were changed several times. It seems that the initial composition may have been tighter with a higher degree of detail and definition, but as he reworked it using his fingers or diluting the paint, the appearance softens. But again, Degas is not hiding the changes. Interestingly, as with the Metropolitan's version, infrared imaging exposed an earlier signature, suggesting at one point that he must have considered the painting finished, though not apparently enough to release to Faure. Now, another related factor that comes into play when discussing the issue of finish is the art market. Degas was by no means oblivious to commercial pressures, and certain pictures were painted expressly for sale. His highly polished fans, for example, were produced simply to appeal to a consumer. And similarly, he knew that ballerinas and racehorses with a very high degree of finish would sell as well. At the other hand of the spectrum, though, are works that are more challenging and experimental and not necessarily produced for a general audience. Degas' work, after all, is for the very few, and those things are for painters and connoisseurs. Mary Cassatt once proclaimed this, and she, and then there was comment on this example of the woman at the window, which when the artist Walter Sickert purchased it in 1901, announced, "I've just bought Degas' finest work. I've had my eye on it for 12 years. And this painting is executed in very thinned oil, or peinture à l'essence, has a very minimalist appearance, closer to an ébauche than a finished picture. But of course, it's just what would appeal to an artist." Now, similarly, Degas' monotypes were also appreciated more by artists than the commercial market. But what he did with some of his monotypes is rather interesting. Again, considering the art market and the necessity of being able to sell his works, some of the monotypes were also he put a layer of pastel over some of his monotypes, and for these works, Degas usually would take a second, weaker impression of the monotype, and add a layer of pastel, which is what you see here. Now, the use of pastel served two purposes. It introduced color, of course, but it also subtly altered the surface and transformed what was a very unpolished, abstract image into something more refined and conventional. It's no coincidence that many of Degas' pastel-covered prints display the traditional signs of finish that we find on a painting, signatures and dates, and that so many of them were sold by the artist. These were works that were intended for public consumption. Now, although the initial monotypes are not unfinished, one can in fact acknowledge a parallel between the unfinished painting being pulled together in the same way that a pastelized version of a monotype's finished or at least prettified the original work. The abstraction of the monotype also mimics these elements which draw people to identify some of Degas' paintings as unfinished. What Degas considered to be an acceptable level of finish was quite fluid. It was subject to change over time and at least to some degree dependent upon the intended audience. Now, even works that Degas presumed to be finished and those that he had sold or exhibited or signed could, of course, as you now know, could fall into this impulse towards transformation. And it could be argued that for Degas, there never was such a thing as a finished painting at all. Every painting perhaps existed in a state of flux, inviting him to return to it over and over again, offering unlimited possibilities. And when his crestfallen dealer, Vollard, discovered a nearly completed sculpture by Degas destroyed and returned to its previous state of a ball of wax, Degas simply said, "The pleasure that I derived from this was the start, being able to start over and over again." Now, I hope that these observations entice you to think about this whole thorny question of finish, and not simply with Degas, but in general when you look at paintings, and not simply to identify which paintings are finished and which aren't, but to consider these elements that might be critical to identify finish in a conventional picture, and then again, what do we find with an artist like Degas, exceptionally innovative and experimental? Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.